Thank you. It was a cool, clear day during the Feast of Tabernacles, and millions of people were tuned in to the third game of the World Series between the Oakland Athletics and the San Francisco Giants. It was the Bay Area Series, as they called it, because both of the teams were out there in the Bay Area, which doesn't happen too often that two teams from the same location or same area get together for the World Series. As people were watching, all of a sudden the picture started shaking and becoming blurry. The announcers, the commentators and the broadcasters, Al Michaels and his cohorts, Jim Palmer and Tim McCarver, were not sure what was going on, and they were sort of confused. They couldn't quite figure it out right away. Wondered what in the world is happening here. But it didn't take long for them to get it figured out, to see what was going on. They were in the middle of an earthquake. This was a major, major earthquake. It's become known as the Loma Prieta earthquake, and it was on October the 17th, 1989. Now, many of you, some of you weren't even born in 1989, but some of us were, including myself. And I remember, I think I might have been watching the game at the time, or if I wasn't watching the game, I soon tuned in when I heard about it, because earthquakes, this was the first earthquake that was broadcast live on TV. And it was because of the fact that the World Series was going on. Let me share some information about this earthquake. Again, as I said, it happened and occurred on October the 17th, 1989 at 5:04 p.m. local time. The shock was centered in the forest of Nicene Marks State Park, about 10 miles northeast of Santa Cruz, on a section of the San Andreas Fault. And you may remember that the San Andreas Fault goes through there, and I forget how far it goes, but it covered both Oakland and San Francisco. And there are a number of fault lines in the U.S., the San Andreas probably being the most famous and maybe the most deadly or powerful of them. The shock was responsible for 63 deaths and 3,757 injuries. Now, quite frankly, that was not as nearly as bad as it could have been. There was even a tsunami involved in it, and the tsunami was in the Monterey Bay, but it was a non-destructive tsunami. But I say that it could have been a lot more destructive if it hadn't been for the World Series taking place. Due to the sports coverage of that event, it became the first major earthquake that was televised, as I said. But rush hour traffic in the Bay Area freeways was lighter than normal because so many people were in their homes watching the game, or beginning to watch the game, because it was just beginning. And this may have prevented a larger than would have normally been expected loss of life for such a massive earthquake, a 6.9 on the Richter scale earthquake. And several of the major Bay Area's major transportation thoroughfares or structures suffered catastrophic damage. I remember seeing one of the freeways, and I forget its price, the Nimitz Freeway, where you saw, I think there were three high, and you saw the collapse of that freeway structure. All of a sudden, there was no freeway there. It was just gone. And cars, people, a number of people got killed in that location. But again, it could have been a lot worse had the freeways been more jam-packed with traffic as they normally would have been. Let me read you a few of the statistics from this particular earthquake. Again, it was October the 17th at 5:04 p.m. And it only lasted, amazingly, it only lasted somewhere between 8 and 15 seconds. Now, I'm sure that might have seemed like 8 to 15 minutes to those who were experiencing it, or maybe even longer because of the intensity of it and so forth, the fear that would have gripped people from such a catastrophic event. It went 12 miles deep. It was obviously a very costly earthquake. $5.6 to $6 billion worth of damage was done. There was a tsunami, and there were 1,000 to 4,000, somewhere between 1,000 and 4,000 landslides that were involved or caused by this particular earthquake. There were foreshocks and tremors also in June of 27th, 1988, a year and some months before this. There was a 5.3 magnitude earthquake in the area, and they measure, there's a scale, Richter scale they call it, that measures earthquakes, and there was a 5.3 in June of 88, and then again in August of 89, there was another 5.4 magnitude earthquake. Now we might say, well, yeah, but that's California. We don't get any earthquakes around here. But you might be surprised to learn that we have had over 200 earthquakes above a 2 point magnitude since the founding of this country, 1776. But we do have them in this area. Ohio is on the periphery of the New Madrid fault line, which goes through Missouri. And we do have seismic activity or earthquake activity in this area, but not to the extent, generally speaking, of somewhere like the West Coast, the Bay Area, and so on. But we do have them. There was one earthquake, three areas of the state, the western and the south, eastern and the northeastern, are the most predominant areas in Ohio that we might get earthquakes and have had earthquakes. I remember in 1986, in January, I had a wood stove, a wood burner in my house at that time, and all of a sudden it had baffles in it. And all of a sudden, those baffles started rattling. And I couldn't figure out why that would be. And then later on that afternoon, we began to hear of an earthquake in northern Ohio. I think it was in Ashtabula County, maybe. And it reached into Pennsylvania, and it reached into southern Ohio. And it could be felt in quite a wide area at the time. But we, again, aren't plagued with or aren't subject to earthquakes, generally speaking, to the magnitude or to the extent or frequency of some other areas like the West Coast. Now, there just was an earthquake here not too long ago, and I forget what country it was, but it was just recently. There was a pretty big one that did quite a bit of damage, and it was pretty devastating to those who were on the ground in that location. The problem with earthquakes, they're hard to predict. The time and date is almost impossible to predict. It's not easy to predict an earthquake. In fact, here is an interesting fact. The goal of earthquake prediction, obviously, is to give warning ahead of time. And since they're not able to do that very well, today's scientists understand that earthquakes they understand earthquakes a lot better than they did in the past, but they still can't match the earthquake predicting prowess of, are you ready for this? The common toad. The toad can predict earthquakes better than scientists can. A 2010 study published in the journal Zoology found that 96% of the male toads in a population abandoned their breeding site 5 days before an earthquake that struck Aquila, Italy in 2009, about 46 miles away. Researchers weren't quite sure how the toads do this, but it's believed that they can detect subtle signs such as the release of gases and charged particles that may occur before a quake. And I guess the moral of that story is keep some toads around. It would help in this particular case. And besides, it's a myth that you're going to get warts from toads. That's not really true anyway. But all that to say, we're just not particularly good, scientists and so forth, are just not particularly good at predicting the day and the hour when an earthquake might occur. Now, I'm not saying this to warn you so much about earthquakes, obviously, since we're not plagued with them or subject to them all that much. But nonetheless, they could occur. But here is what I want to pose. If the people of Loma Prieta and the San Francisco Bay Area had known on October the 15th what was going to happen on October the 17th, do you think that maybe, just maybe, things would have been a little bit different? They might have taken a different direction than they did? Would you think that they would have done something different than actually ended up happening? Well, they did sort of know that because, as I said, there were some indicators. There were some tremors, and there were a couple of, in 88, as I mentioned, and in 89, earlier in 89, there were some other smaller earthquakes. So it's not like they weren't completely oblivious to the fact that an earthquake could occur, but yeah, they were lulled to sleep a little bit. You know, it's like a bell ringing when something's supposed to happen, and well, the bell rings and nothing much happens, and then the bell rings again, nothing much happens, and pretty soon you don't even remember hearing the bell ringing. It's like those car alarms. I hear them all the time. And I don't see people come running to check and see what's going on. People ho-hum. It's no big deal. It happens all the time. Well, that's what sort of happened in Loma Prieta. But I'm here to tell you there is the most powerful earth-shaking event in history is ahead of us. And the fall holy days, especially the fall holy days, all the holy days play a part in it, the plan of God, but especially the fall holy days sort of point that out. We heard some of that in the first message. What I want to talk about today is the urgency of our calling. The urgency of our calling. The title is Ho-Hum or High Time. Ho-Hum or High Time. I want to point out or pose another question. If the New Testament church had known 2,000 years ago that it was going to be another 2,000 years, maybe plus, minus, whatever, it would be that far down the road before the return of Jesus Christ, do you think that might have come through in their message in the New Testament? I would venture to say that it would have, if they had known that it was that far down the road. Now, there was a man that did know that it wasn't going to be in his time, and that was Daniel. And if you would turn back to Daniel, the 7th chapter, we heard a little bit about Daniel earlier. Daniel, the 7th chapter, Daniel says in verse 13, I was watching in the night visions, and behold, one like the Son of Man coming with the clouds of heaven. He came to the Ancient of Days, and they brought him near before him. Then to him was given dominion and glory and a kingdom that all peoples, nations, and languages should serve him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion which shall not pass away, and his kingdom the one which shall not be destroyed. He saw in the night visions one like the Son of Man coming in the clouds of heaven. But why do I say that he knew it wasn't going to be in his time? Well, just towards the back of the book of Daniel, in the 12th chapter, verse 4, it says, "But you, Daniel, shut up the words and seal the book until the time of the end. Many shall run to and fro, and knowledge shall increase." Has it ever exploded? With the advent of the computer, knowledge has gotten to the almost the extreme. Dropping all the way to the last verse of the book and the last verse of the chapter, verse 13. But he says, "You," speaking to Daniel, "go your way till the end, for you shall rest and will arise to your inheritance at the end of the days," or at the end of the age, when Christ, when that Son of Man comes through the clouds. That's when Daniel's going to rest till. So he was told, he knew, that he wasn't going to be witnessing these things, at least not in his lifetime, in his physical lifetime at that time. But the New Testament church, the message was way more urgent. It was more urgent than, and I'm not saying that Daniel's message is not urgent, but it wasn't as urgent for himself. The New Testament church gives a completely different twist on the message, gives a completely different proclamation, if you will, of the message. Turn to Mark, the 13th chapter. This is, we were earlier in Matthew 24. This is the parallel, along with Luke 21, this is the parallel to the Olivet prophecy of Matthew 24. In Mark 13, and in verse 26, speaks about the same event that Daniel was talking about. It says, "Then they will see the Son of Man coming in the clouds with great power and glory." They will see the Son of Man, just like Daniel said, coming in great. He had gone through what's going to happen leading up to this. False Christ. There will be all types of things going on leading up to verse 26. But then he said, "You will see the Son of Man coming in the clouds with great power." And it gets more urgent as we begin to dissect and as we begin to look at some of the passages in the New Testament, and it becomes more urgent and the message gets more urgent. It gets more to the point. It gets more, it has, unlike in Daniel's, it has more "you shall," "you need to," "do this," and so forth. It gets more of an immediacy to it. Luke, the 19th chapter, if you want to turn over there, Luke chapter 19. There's an interesting story here. In fact, this particular chapter, and we're probably all fairly familiar with it, but this particular chapter, there have been lots of little children's songs written about this and so forth, all kinds of sermons and whatnot done about done here on this particular story. And it was in verse 1 is where we'll start. "So then Jesus entered and passed through Jericho." Now Jericho was probably, in Jesus' mind, was probably a prominent, pretty prominent. He had probably some strong recollections of that, because obviously, as we remember, the Israelites encircled it for 7 days, and then the walls came collapsing and so on and so forth. But more than that, his direct lineage went through Jericho, because in his lineage is Rahab, who lived in Jericho. So Jesus probably had somewhat of a fondness for it. "But now behold, there was a man named Zacchaeus, who was a chief tax collector, and he was rich." Tax collectors, you might remember Matthew or Levi was a tax collector, one of the disciples, became an apostle. He was also a tax collector, but he was not of the rank of a Zacchaeus. And the way they got rich is they extorted money from people. They were hired by the Romans to collect taxes for them. And what they would do, they would collect a lot more taxes than the people were due to pay. And that's how they became wealthy. And it says here that he was rich, so probably he had been involved in some of this extortion that went on with tax collectors. And he sought to see who Jesus was, but he could not because of the crowd. He was, they called him, his nickname was Shorty. He was real short, and so he couldn't see. Everybody else was towered over him, and he couldn't see over him or around him. So he ran and he climbed up into a sycamore tree to see him, being Christ, for he was going to pass. It would remind you of a parade. People line the parade streets of a parade, and they'll sit on chairs and they'll put little kids on piggyback on the shoulders so they can see the horses or the fire trucks and all the things, all the excitement going by. Well, this is sort of what he was trying to do, getting up in the sycamore tree so that he could see. And when Jesus came to the place, he looked up and saw him and said to him, "Zacchaeus, make haste. Come down, for today I must stay at your house." So he did. He hurried up and he got down and he took him to his house. And then he began to sort of make excuses for himself and say, "You know what? If I ever cheat people out of money, I give it back fourfold," and so on and so forth. And Jesus said to him, "Today salvation has come to this house." Now, it was salvation. It wasn't the end of the age. It was just salvation. But he informed him that it had been done. "For the Son of Man has come to seek and to save that which was lost." But that was that was the beginning. That was only the beginning. It wasn't the end. It wasn't the culmination of the plan. It was just part of the intermediate plan. But in verse 11 is what we want to focus on now. "Now, as they heard these things," that's the crowds that were around, or the people in Zacchaeus' house, "he spoke another parable because he was near Jerusalem and because they thought the kingdom of God would appear immediately." They thought it was going to happen now. They thought Christ had come to take over and put the Romans in their place and to take over and restore the kingdom to Israel or to Judah and so forth. They thought it was going to be immediate. If you go through the entire New Testament up until the latter portions or parts of the ministry of the disciples and apostles, you will see that that same attitude and thought prevails, that they thought it was going to be immediate. In Acts, the first chapter, for example, this was after Christ had been resurrected, after he'd been crucified, and then after he had the stone was rolled away and the tomb was empty. After he had been resurrected, he said he had told them to to stay around Jerusalem and so forth. And then in verse 6, that therefore when they had come together, they asked him, saying, "Lord, will you at this time restore the kingdom to Israel?" Their thinking was physical, but it was immediate. It was immediate. "Will you at this time restore the kingdom?" And he said to them, "It is not for you to know the times or the seasons which the Father has put in his own authority." It's not for you to know, he said, when this is going to happen. But you shall receive power, and so on and so forth, he goes on to say. Even back, just one in my Bible, just across the page in John 21st chapter, is a story of Peter and Jesus Christ making him. Peter had denied Christ 3 times, and Jesus Christ made Peter confess him 3 times. "Peter, do you love me?" "Yes, I love you." And again, "Peter, do you love me?" "Yes, you know that I love me." And about the third time, Peter got sort of exasperated. You know, Lord, that I love you. And Jesus said, well, then feed my sheep. But he made him do it three times. And then he tells him in verse 18, most assuredly, I say to you, when you were younger, you girded yourself and you did what you wanted. You went where you wanted to. But when you are old, you will stretch out your hands and somebody else is going to dress you and take you where they want you to go, not where you wish to go. This he spoke, verse 19, signifying by what death he would glorify God. And when he had spoken this, he said to him, follow me. Then Peter turned around and he saw John, who had been at the Passover supper and leaned on Christ's breast and had asked Christ about who's going to be the one who betrays him and so forth. Peter, seeing him, said to Jesus, but Lord, what about him? What about this man? Well, it's the same response that we often have when somebody says, Freeman, you go mow the lawn. Well, what about Johnny? Why doesn't Johnny have to do it? Why do I have to do it? This is sort of the same type of response that Jesus Christ got. What about him? Well, Jesus said, if I will that he remain till I come, what is that to you? You follow me. Then this saying went out among the brethren that this disciple, being John, would not die. But Jesus hadn't said that. And here's an indication of what is written into or how the New Testament was written. There's an indication right here. Yet Jesus did not say to him that he would not die, but only that if I want him to remain till I come, what's that to you? But again, they were thinking in the physical. They were thinking now, the here and now, and the present day. But that's not what the plan was. But if there's no urgency, we tend to fall asleep. If there's nothing to sort of prod and goad us on, then we tend to sort of lean back and we tend to sort of become a little dull, a little lackadaisical, and so forth. And we tend to be a lot less enthusiastic. We tend to be a lot less motivated to do what we should be doing. And that went for them, and it also still goes for us. Now, don't get me wrong. I'm not here to say, oh, we got lots of time, and don't worry about it. Everybody has always thought it was going to be the last time, which is true, but that's not the point. The point is that we always need to have urgency. We always need to be ready. In 1 Thessalonians 4, this is now on these other places we read was basically on a physical level. 1 Thessalonians 4 is on a spiritual level. See if I can find 1 Thessalonians 4. I know it's in there. And we'll start in verse 15. And you'll notice the wording here that Paul, he's writing to the brethren in Thessalonica, and some of those folks had thought that there is no resurrection or that the resurrection was already past and so forth. He had to deal with this on several occasions. That I don't know if it was the Sadducees that had been converted and had brought some of their they didn't believe in a resurrection. I don't know if that was who this was about or not, but their attitude may have crept into the church for all we know. Verse 15, for this we say to you by the word of the Lord, that we who are alive and remain. If we back up just a little bit, I do not want, in verse 13, I do not want you to be ignorant, brethren, concerning those who have fallen asleep, in other words, those who have died, lest you sorrow as others who have no hope. For if we believe that Jesus died and rose again, even so God will bring with him those who sleep in Jesus. For this we say to you by the word of the Lord, that we, and he thought that he was going to be among those who were going to be alive and remain until the coming of the Lord. And verse 16, for the Lord himself will descend from heaven with a shout and with the voice of an archangel and with the trumpet of God, and the dead in Christ will rise first. Then he repeats it. Then we who are alive and remain shall be caught up together with him. And therefore, verse 18, comfort one another with these words. And it is a comforting thing to know, but there was an immediacy and urgency because he thought he was going to be there and Christ was going to come back in his lifetime. I remember when we first started, and I think I might have mentioned this before, when we first started coming to the church, that was way back in 1969, which seems like a long time ago now. And it probably was a long time ago, I guess. But at any rate, we had just come out of the Amish faith, and we had driven nothing but horses and buggies and so forth. And I had gotten my driver's license. I always tell people it's sort of a man bites dog story. I had the driver's license, and my dad had the learner's permit. And so, we decided we were going to go buy a car. And my dad said, now let's get a good one, because this is the last one that we will ever need. Well, of course, he had many cars after that. But we, at that point, we felt like that by 1975, which was just 6 short years in the future, Christ would have returned and we would be in God's kingdom. And that is still happening today. And let me tell you, it's a good thing. It's not a bad thing that we think that Christ is going to return soon. And I think that. I believe most people do. But if you turn back to Mark, the 13th chapter, it was, let me mention, that car was a tank. It was an Oldsmobile Delta 88, and it was as heavy as a small battleship, and it was a good car, and it lasted him for a long time, but not till Christ returned, that's for sure. Back to Mark, the 13th chapter, where we were a little bit ago. Let me run you through some of the urgent words and wording that is in Mark, the 13th chapter. Verse 5, to start with, says, take heed. Take heed that no one deceives you. Dropping down to verse 9, watch out. Another or more words of urgency. In verse 14, says, flee. We heard a little bit about that we should flee in the first message. They said flee. All words of urgency and all words of immediacy. The way it's written, it could have applied then, and it applies just as well today. When the invention of gunpowder took place, and I can't remember, I probably should have looked it up, in what year or when that was, but people thought, wow, this is it. This is the end of civilization as we know it. It can't go on any longer than this, because now we can shoot each other with guns. And look at how much farther down the road we have come since the invention of gunpowder. Same thing here. Same thing here. In verse 23, again he says, take heed. See, I've told you all these things beforehand. Then he goes into, in verse 28, the parable of the fig tree. Now learn this parable from the fig tree. When its branch has already become tender and puts forth leaves, you know that summer is near. So you also, when you see these things happening, know that it is near at the doors. Those types of things have happened all along, but they're intensifying and intensifying and intensifying. They're happening more rapidly and with greater volume, and they're becoming more deadly all the time, some of the things he talks about. Verse 30, surely I say to you, this generation will by no means pass away till all these things take place. Well, now, he could have meant the generation that he was talking to, or the last generation right at the end. It doesn't specify. If I say I'll pay you, if I owe you something, I say I'll pay you in March, I'm not saying that I'll pay you in March 2019. I'm just saying I'll pay you in March. It could be any March, further down the road or whatever. And that's sort of the principle here. Heaven and earth will pass away, but my words will by no means pass away. It is going to happen. It will take place. But of that day and hour no one knows. Take heed, again in verse 33, watch and pray, for you do not know when the time is. It's like a man going into a far country who left his house and gave authority to his servants and to each his work and commanded the doorkeeper to keep watch. Watch, therefore, for you do not know when the master of the house is coming back, in the evening, at midnight, at the crowing of the rooster, or in the morning, lest coming suddenly he find you and me sleeping. And what I say to you, I say to all, watch. In other words, we don't want to be lulled asleep just because we think my master delays his coming. If the people in San Francisco had known the day before, or 2 days before, or a week before, whatever, that there was an earthquake, a deadly earthquake coming in October of 1989, they would have taken action. They would have gone, and they would have left the area. What do all these things have in common? Of course, urgency. But why is urgency, again, so important? Well, we've already touched on it, but a message with no urgency is an invitation to lethargy. It's an invitation to fall asleep. It's an invitation to ho-hum, I will do it later. Mitch was talking about the saying that they have, and I'm sorry, I apologize, I didn't get, he mentioned it, but I didn't get it. I mean, I didn't memorize the saying, but that I'll do it tomorrow. Well, this is the attitude that we're going to have if there is no urgency to the message, if there is no urgency to our calling. If there is nothing in sales, for example, at the end of the sales pitch, you're supposed to ask for the sale, and you're supposed to put a deadline on it or something that causes them to, hey, I better do this or I'll miss out. And that's the same way with a message of this kind, with no urgency or no nothing to stir you to action. That's why the Bible is written like it is, so that we do not know the hour or the day when that's going to happen, so that we can be spurred on and motivated to do things. That trumpet can sound for us at any time, whether it's now or at the return of Jesus Christ. Doesn't mean that the trumpet can't sound for us personally. We were just reminded of that this morning. We were in our house and the emergency squad came to the neighbor's house, and so we looked on the phone, and the neighbor's wife had called us several times. So my wife called them back, and the lady says, yeah, I came down from bed this morning, and because her husband has arthritis, he sleeps on the couch. And she said, I came down, and I found him, and he had died. He was gone. It can happen that quick. It can happen at any time, for us or anyone else for that matter. But notice in Luke, the 12th chapter, Luke 12. We'll begin in verse 42. Verse 42, the Lord said, who then is that faithful and wise steward whom his master will make ruler over his household to give him their, or give them their portion of food in due season? Blessed is that servant whom his master will find so doing when he comes. Truly I say to you that he will make him ruler of all that he has. But if that servant says in his heart, my master is delaying his coming, and begins to beat the male and female servants and eat and drink and be drunk, the master of that day, or of that servant, will come on a day when he is not looking for him. It can happen. It can happen, and it does at times. So we don't want to fall into that category. We can't afford to go about our life ho-hum and neglect our calling and let ourselves be distracted by other things from the outside. Things that, while they're maybe seem important at the moment, are really just background noise. They're really just white noise, as they say. They really are not good for anything except for distracting us. And Satan is very, very, very clever at doing that. It is incumbent upon us to have a sense of urgency about the calling and about the calling that God, our election that God has given us. Romans the 13th chapter, Romans 13 and in verse 11. We'll just look at one verse, verse 11. And where it's in a context, the context of loving your neighbor and doing some of the things that we're supposed to be doing. But in verse 11, Paul says to the church in Rome, do this knowing the time that now it is high time to wake out of sleep, for now our salvation is nearer than when we first believed. As I mentioned, we thought when we first came to the church, we thought that it was only going to be a few short years, several years, and then it would be all over. Well, it's gone longer, a lot longer time, but it is nearer than when we first believed. There's no doubt about that. Whether that is the return of Christ or our return to the earth, either way, it is nearer than what it was. There's an urgency on purpose written into the New Testament, into the Bible in general, to spur people on, to motivate people. The Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, John, and some of the apostles and disciples, Peter and Paul and James and so on, they had an urgency about them. They didn't know when the time was going to be, but they knew that there was an urgency to get the word out. They knew that there was an urgency to do the right thing, to live their lives the right way, because they knew that at some point it was going to be over. If the people of the San Francisco Bay Area had known on October the 15th again, they would have done things differently. 63 people might not have died, and 3,757 people may not have been injured, because they would have evacuated and they would have prepared. There are things you can do to prepare for an earthquake. You can fasten things in your house and so forth. But evacuation is the best plan to get away from it. They would have prepared, but there was no sense of urgency for them because they had heard all this before. They had heard it many times. It could be a massive earthquake, but they've been saying that for 20 years, and it's never happened. Oh, we've had a few little ones and a few tremors and a few this and a few that, but we've never really had an earthquake. But one day they did have an earthquake. The bell was ringing and they ignored it, and it happened. It happened. For our final scripture, turn to Luke, the 12th chapter, sort of a directive for us. Luke, the 12th chapter. We will start in verse 35. Luke 12, 35, and we'll read 35 and 36. This is sort of our marching orders, so to speak. Verse 35, it said, let your waist be girded and your lamps burning. And you yourselves be like men who wait for their master when he will return from the wedding, that when he comes and knocks, they may open to him immediately. Be ready. We do not know the day and the hour. It is important that we maintain a sense of urgency, a sense of the fact that it is important to be ready now, today, always, that we don't develop a ho-hum, my Lord delays his coming attitude. The fall holy days should spur us on to some of those things, the urgency. It should produce a sense of urgency, a greater sense of urgency, because we're rehearsing, and we do this every year, but we're rehearsing what is going to happen. And at some point, the future is going to be now for us or at Christ's return. So can we afford to have a ho-hum attitude, or should we take the attitude that it's high time we continue to get ourselves ready? After all, we wouldn't want to miss out on the biggest, greatest, earth-shaking event of all time.